Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. If you're a frequent listener to the show, you know that over the course of the past couple of years, we've talked to some of the most highly respected leaders of the global public health community. That makes sense because Atlanta is home to a number of the world's most influential and impactful public health organizations, starting, of course, with the Centers for Disease Control. But we also like having public health workers on the show because we find that they have fascinating stories to tell about the places they've been and the people they've encountered. Our guest today is no exception. He's Dr. Mark Rosenberg, the president and CEO of the Task Force for Global Health. Chances are you may never have heard of the task force, despite the fact that it's the largest nonprofit in Georgia, and this past year was ranked by Forbes magazine as the fourth largest charity organization in the United States. The task force occupies a nondescript office building across from the DeKalb County Courthouse in Decatur. It houses a number of programs dedicated to fighting disease in some of the most impoverished regions of the world. The task force was founded more than 30 years ago with the mission of improving global immunization rates for childhood diseases. In partnership with the World Health Organization and the World Bank, they succeeded. They increased the rates from 20% of all children in the mid-80s to 80% just over a decade later. Now, in its expanded role, the task force reaches some 435 million people in more than 135 countries. Mark Rosenberg has been head of the task force since 1999. Before that, he spent 20 years at CDC, where he worked on smallpox eradication, HIV/AIDS, and other diseases, and most notably on injury prevention and control, which you'll hear a lot more about later. Rosenberg set to retire from his long career in medicine and from the task force at the end of this month. So this seemed like just the right time to conduct an exit interview. Dr. Mark Rosenberg, thank you so much for being here for Two-Way Street. It's really wonderful to see you. I want to talk to you about your path, personal path, as you come close to your retirement through the world of global public health. You once told an interviewer, "I grew up in a family that was committed to social service and community action, health, medicine, public welfare. I had a father who was very interested and active in his unions." And you said he didn't go to college until he'd put all of you in the family, all the kids through school. But then he did, yes?
Mm-hmm. Till he put his three kids through college.
And you point out that your mother was a physician who practiced for 61 years in Montclair, New Jersey. You say she did some very good things during her time in medicine. What does that mean?
Well, I think she was a role model. My mother was someone who believed very strongly in the things that she believed in. And I think one was helping others and serving others. She was the first physician in our town, Montclair, New Jersey, to see African-American patients in her office. And for a long time, she was the only one who would do that. She worked actively for Planned Parenthood for many years, donating her services. And when she finished, when she retired, she'd been practicing 61 years, she had known her patients, the patients she had at the end, she had known them for an average of 35 years.
Wow.
And you can imagine what the relationship is and how it grows. I think that relationship is so important, and there's a real risk that in medicine today, we're not only limiting the relationship, but we're writing it out of the equation. Now, when you go to see your doctor, you might, if it's a really serious problem, have 7 minutes, but you might not see the same doctor. And even for mental health problems, because we have electronic medical records now, you may not talk to the same therapist. So these are interactions without what my mother thought was the most important ingredient for good health, an important relationship.
You've said that her work kind of led you toward your career in medicine, I think, yes?
I was inspired by her and what she did and how she helped people and that she found it gratifying.
You said I think you need to understand that if you're really going to work in global health, that there are multiple worlds where people live and are born and get sick and die in parallel universes at the same time. You say, the realization of that had an amazing impact on you. And what you were saying is, you knew what it was like to be sick, but being a doctor is a separate world from being a patient who is sick.
I had always loved photography. And when I was in college, I think instead of studying, I worked on the school paper and must have worked 80 hours a week for 4 years on the paper. And mostly was photography, photography editor, photography chairman. But I believe strongly in the power of photography to tell stories and tell stories about people. But I thought, aha, I can show what it's like to be sick. Because I've been a medical student, a doctor, an intern, a resident. I worked with a general practitioner. My mother was a doctor. I know something about what it's like to be sick and to be a patient. And I'll show people using photographs and interviews. So I set about working on this project. And it was an amazing experience. I followed 6 different people with 6 different illnesses. And what I learned from that was that I thought, as a doctor, I knew what it was like to be a patient, and I didn't. I knew what it was like to be a doctor, and that was so different, the parallel universe. I was so arrogant and misguided in thinking I understood what it's like to be sick.
What did you learn that you hadn't known about what it means to be a patient?
It impacts your world in huge ways. It affects your family and your ability to play the same role in your family, and it might have to change drastically. I followed a young couple where the man in the couple had a stroke, and his wife, who was a concert pianist, said, "Oh my God, what does this mean for my career? If I'm going to have to support him, I won't be able to be a concert pianist." And she really had serious questions about what her life would become. And I think when he came to the hospital to be examined or had an X-ray or went to see someone, they had no idea of the impact on the relationship. Subsequently, at his young age, he was only about 28, he then had a heart attack. And his wife said, "I'm out of here. I'm not going to stay with this. I won't have any career at all." These aspects of illness, most doctors never get involved with. They don't really understand that part of it until it happens to them. And I think it's always such a wake-up call for physicians when they become ill, when they become the patient, they start to understand it.
One of your colleagues at one point years ago, Ann Fadiman, she said, "You don't catch a disease. The disease catches you.
And then you fall down."
Yeah. And she said that she advocated for having every medical chart, having attached to it a photograph of the family that's dealing with this illness. That's exactly what you're talking about now.
And I hadn't read her book at that point, but it's exactly what I did. So I took pictures of the family. One of the family pictures that stands out most clearly in my mind was a woman who was working as a licensed practical nurse and then developed breast cancer. And I remember going to her home in South Boston and seeing the family, meeting the family in her home. And there's a picture there with her son-in-law. Her son-in-law was also a social worker, but he was blind and he had a seeing eye dog. His wife, or the patient's daughter, had a developmental disability and had a hard time navigating in the world. Her husband was in the picture. He had just been told that he had lung cancer. And there was Jean, the patient I was following, who had breast cancer. And I look at the picture, and the only healthy person in the picture was the dog. But I think the doctors had no idea of what she was responsible for, who she was responsible for. And she told me the story that the doctor told her, you go and you decide, do you want a simple mastectomy, in which case you can get back to work in 3 weeks, or do you want a radical mastectomy, which the doctor thought would protect her better into the future, but she'd be out of work for 3 months. And she told me she decided she had to get back to work to take care of her family. So she went and she told the doctor that she wanted the simple mastectomy. And she told me she thought the doctor was angry at her for making that choice. And I said, what made you think that? And she said, when I answered the question, he stood up and walked out. And I think if you don't understand the patient and their context and their story and their setting, I don't think you can be the best doctor.
I'm talking with Dr. Mark Rosenberg. He's the president and CEO of the Task Force for Global Health, based in Decatur. We'll talk more with Dr. Rosenberg after this break. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Mark Rosenberg, the president and CEO of the Decatur-based Task Force for Global Health. Although it flies under the radar, the Task Force is one of the world's largest public health organizations, delivering treatment to more than 400 million people in 135 countries. Dr. Rosenberg is preparing to retire at the end of this month after a career of more than 30 years in public health. What's the report card you would give right now to the state of global health?
In a lot of ways, global health is much better than it's ever been. I think there are fewer people living in extreme poverty. I think more people have access to the means of health. And I think there's more resources going into global health. So I think in many ways, global health is better off. At the same time, because of some changes in the environment, in the world, in the way we raise animals and raise food, because of increased conflict areas around the world, there are many really severe problems that global health has to deal with. And for us, some of these are very new problems. Things like Ebola present new challenges that we just had not been faced with before. We've had Ebola, but we've never had it in a large urban city spreading to other cities, spreading to 3 countries, 4 countries, 5 countries. We'd never been faced with a challenge like that. So the challenges are new. We're more aware of some of these challenges, but I think the state of global health is strong and getting stronger.
Ebola is one that we all really understand the scope of because of the West African epidemic that made headlines around the world. What are some of the other major diseases that you at the task force are working on or that we ought to be aware of that still create significant problems?
Well, I think an operative term here is what should we be aware of? And I think that with Ebola, we became aware of the problem in new heightened ways after someone with Ebola came here to the United States and gave it to someone else. We put it at the headlines of our newspapers, on the talk shows. People were thinking all about Ebola when it became clear that it was a threat to us. The problems that we work on are problems of neglected people, problems that are not a threat to us, but problems that disfigure or destroy the lives of millions of poor people around the world. These are not and will not become a threat to us because of the conditions under which we live. But I think we need to be aware of those diseases, the neglected diseases of neglected people. And the reason we need to pay attention is because when people over there suffer and die, and when they lose their children and destroy their families, that diminishes us as human beings because we share a common humanity.
What are some of the diseases that occupy and have occupied your time at the task force?
We work on a lot of diseases that are called the neglected tropical diseases because they affect people in tropical climes. Some of these are diseases like river blindness that have affected tens of millions and put hundreds of millions of people in Africa at risk of not only blindness, but horrendous itching that's so bad it sometimes pushes people to suicide. Another is blinding trachoma. It's a disease caused by a bacterium, chlamydia. In this country, chlamydia causes a pelvic inflammatory disease. It's a sexually transmitted disease. But in poor countries where there's not water to wash faces, children, young children, get secretions on their face from their eyes, their nose, from the food that they eat, and flies land on their faces. So many flies that the children no longer raise a hand to brush them away. These flies carry the bacteria, chlamydia, and they infect the eyes of these children. And over time, the infection causes scarring on the inside of their eyelids, and it causes their eyelashes to turn in and scratch their eye. It's like thorns scratching your eye, so that your eyelashes that were designed to protect you actually torture you.
Trachoma is an interesting example of what you work on, in part because of just what an awful disease it is for so many people in third world countries, especially in Africa. But also because, if I'm correct, the treatment for it is so straightforward and basically simple. Zithromax, a drug that we're all familiar with getting prescribed to us here for a variety of conditions that we have when we go into our doctor's office, that takes care of trachoma, right?
It's an amazing story, Bill, an amazing, amazing story. But what they found is exactly what you said, that if you treat someone with Zithromax just once, you can get rid of the infection from their eyes. You can get rid of the infection from their face. And if you treat a whole family, you can get rid of the infection in the family. If you treat a whole village, you can get rid of the infection in the village. You know the rest of the story. If you treat a whole district, get rid of it in the district. Treat the whole country, you get rid of it in the country. And treat every country where they have trachoma, you can get rid of the disease and protect so many people, not just the people at risk now, but children who are not yet born. The potential to improve the world for so many people is unlimited.
You've traveled to a number of the countries where your work is unfolding. And we should point out that one of the roles of the task force is that you become a supply chain connection between pharmaceutical companies and the people who need those drugs, like Azithromax, right? So you're delivering massive quantities of pharmaceuticals because the drug companies work with you to make sure that these drugs get in the hands of the people who need them that you work with, right?
It's a story of extraordinary partnerships that I think most people have no clue as to what's going on. So starting with this problem of blinding trachoma, Pfizer, one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world, if not the largest, donates Zithromax that we take Z-Pax for a respiratory infection. They donate it to us, and we in turn deliver it to ministries of health and help them organize programs to systematically treat people. So Pfizer this year will donate to us about 100 million treatments. That's three pills on the average for treatment. Each pill has a value of about $10. You're talking of something like $3 billion worth of Zithromax that Pfizer donates to improve the lives of people we never see.
Big Pharma is under fire and under attack frequently, and I'm not here to judge whether they deserve to be or not, but I do know that at one point early on in the history of the task force, there were some who were critical of the relationship that was being forged between the task force and Big Pharma because of the dark cloud that sometimes hovers over the pharmaceutical industry, right?
Absolutely. And again, the task force was started by three visionary people who left CDC to work on raising the level of immunization of children, Bill Foege, Bill Watson, and Carol Walters. And Bill Foege, after 6 years or 3 years of successful work on raising childhood immunizations, was approached by the CEO of Merck, a man named Roy Vagelos, who made an offer that Bill Foege felt he couldn't refuse. Roy Vagelos said, "We have this drug. It's an amazing drug, ivermectin or Mectazam. We will donate it to you as much as you need for as long as you need it till you can get rid of river blindness in Africa." It was a disease that affected tens of millions of people and put hundreds of millions at risk for blindness. It was devastating the country. And Roy Vagelos said, "We make plenty of money on it for veterinary purposes. It's the medicine that we use as HeartGuard. If you have a dog, it's what you give your dog to prevent heartworm." They said, "We make plenty of profit on it from veterinary purposes, and we're not going to make a lot of money from poor people in Africa, so we'll donate it to you. If you help us distribute it, we'll give it to you for free." And Bill Foege thought this was a wonderful, wonderful offer, and he went to his staff, and he asked them, "Should we do this? Look at this incredible offer." And to a person, they all said the same thing, "Absolutely not." They said, "Don't do it. Don't you understand Big Pharma? That's the devil incarnate. They're awful. They gouge people on prices. They work not for the good of mankind, but for profit for their shareholders. It's business driven." They said, "Stay away. You don't want to do anything with Big Pharma because you'll give us a bad name. You go back and you tell Roy Vagelos no." So Bill Foege thanked them, and he went back, and Roy Vagelos asked him again. He said, "Will you do this?" And Bill Foege said, "Yes.
Absolutely.
I'll do it," because he saw the good that might come of it. And because he said yes, now we've helped treat more than a billion people. And this disease, the blinding part of it at least, has almost been eliminated from all of Africa. And people now think that we could actually eliminate the whole disease, the infection itself, from most of Africa.
I've often said to people that the Task Force for Global Health is one of the best kept secrets in the state of Georgia. You really are. The work you do is profound in its reach, and yet you've remained relatively unknown to most people here.
I think Bill Foege told us most of the work we do, all of the work we do, is through partnerships. And partnerships and coalitions, it's hard to make them work. And one of the things Bill learned and taught us was that if you want to make your coalition work, shine the light on your partners and not on yourself.
Well, that's a great conversation to have. Bill Foege was here to have a conversation some time ago with me. And one of the things we talked about, and that I know that you think has been very inspiring about him, is the story of the last few months that he worked in India toward the eradication of smallpox. And the story is that he decided to leave some 6 months when he saw that we were going to have the final case of smallpox, which he had worked so hard with so many people to eradicate. When he saw it was about to happen, he contacted CDC and said, "I'm packing up with my family and coming home." And they said, "You can't come home now. You're about to eradicate the disease." And he said, "No, now's exactly when I have to come home." And why did he make that decision?
Well, his boss said to him, "Don't you understand that you're about to eradicate smallpox from India, something no one ever thought possible? You did it in record time. This is going to be the greatest achievement of global health in the history of the earth. You've got to stay there because it's going to be a huge, huge celebration. Don't you understand that?" Then Bill said to his boss, David Sensor, a wonderful man, he said, "Yes, boss, I understand. But you see, it's the Indian people who did this, and they deserve the credit. They need the credit, and they should get the credit. But if a foreigner is here, then all the credit will go to the foreigners. So, boss, I'm coming home."
And so Bill Foege, one of the founders of Task Force, taught that lesson, and it's one of the reasons that you, in running the organization, have been, to some extent, satisfied with keeping a low profile at the task force.
I think we find that keeping a low profile and shining the light on our partners helps. And someone said, credit is infinitely divisible. It doesn't hurt to spread it around. There's an infinite supply of credit that you can give to people. But I think that was Bill's advice for running effective coalitions. And I think coalitions are like a marriage. It's very easy to get into one, but it's very hard to make it work. I'm glad you laughed, because when I used to talk, I would get into arguments with people. Inevitably, I would say this, that it's easy to get into, but hard to make it work. And someone every time would raise their hand and they say, "Dr. Rosenberg, it's not hard for me. I've been married. We never argue. We never go to sleep angry." And I would say to them, "Really? Really?" Because it was so different from my own experience where we argue every night. And I can't count the nights that we've gone to bed angry. But we work on it, but it takes work. And I would get into these ridiculous arguments with them, and I was so dumb, because it took me a while to realize that there are some people who just lie. They won't tell you the truth. It's hard. Coalitions are hard. But Bill's advice to give the credit, shine the light on your partners, I think is very good advice, and it served us well.
I'm talking with Dr. Mark Rosenberg. He's the president and CEO of the Task Force for Global Health, based in Decatur. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, I'll talk to Dr. Rosenberg about two notorious episodes in which his work in public health slammed him headlong into the unyielding wall of politics. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. My guest is Dr. Mark Rosenberg. Rosenberg is one of the most respected leaders in his field. But as we recap his career, I wanted to talk about two notorious episodes in which his pursuit of public health and safety ran him afoul of powerful political forces, and in the second case, cost him his job. I want to talk about one of the cases you worked on earlier. Early in your career, what happened at Crater Lake? It sounds like the title of a detective novel, The Incident at Crater Lake.
Well, you know, Crater Lake is in, I think, southwest Oregon, and it is billed as one of the eight wonders of the world because it's a lake that's 2,000 feet deep that fills up the crater of a now extinct volcano. And it's billed as having the world's cleanest water. But we started to get word that at Crater Lake National Park,
people— This is at CDC.
I was at CDC, and this was in about 1974, I think, or 75. And we got word that people who were visiting Crater Lake were getting sick. And Crater Lake, being this high tourist destination, had about 3,000 visitors a day. And the reports we were getting was that large numbers of visitors to the park were getting sick. So a colleague and I were sent out there to investigate this. And we said, we need to check the water system, because when so many people are getting sick, you think, is there some common source that people are being exposed to? And water is one of the first ones you think about.
We should point out, when you say people were getting sick, you came across one employee of the national park who had lost like 35 pounds in a matter of a couple of months. This was dramatic illness, not just sort of a few days of flu-like symptoms.
No, you're right. It was very serious. And that was the park superintendent, the person that's supposed to be in charge, who works with the National Park Service, who's supposed to keep it safe and keep it healthy for his staff and the visitors. Almost all of his staff had become sick.
And they told you when you got there, your immediate impulse was to say, well, it must be the water supply. But the water came from Crater Lake, and they assured you it was the purest water in the world, right?
The park staff did, but the people who worked under them showed me the results of water samples that they had surreptitiously, stealthily sent in to a private lab to have them tested because they suspected the water. And these samples came back and they had really, really high coliform counts. And I thought these samples were really bad and this was scary. So we set about examining the water system. But even though this was July, there was snow on the ground because Crater Lake is very high. And there was 7 feet of snow. Over the next couple of days, the snow melted and we were able to actually examine the water system. And it turned out that it had been jimmied, so that the chlorine, which was supposed to be injected into this water, wasn't being injected into it at all. And then we poured dye, fluorescein dye, into the toilets. And we thought if it was contaminated, if the water was contaminated with sewage, when you held up the water to a UV light, it would fluoresce green. You ordinarily couldn't see it, and it was inert, so if people drank it, it wouldn't hurt them. But even one part per million would show up as green when you exposed it to UV light. Well, we did this, and what we saw was not a little bit of a hint of one part per million of fluorescein in the water, but we looked down the mountainside, and there, going from a clogged-up sewer, was this sludge coming out of a backed-up manhole. Sludge was going down the hill right into the little stream that supplied the water. It was horrendously contaminated, and we argued to have the park closed, and they did close it after putting up some resistance. But it was the first time that a national park had been closed for illness. So we thought we had done a good job. We were only out there for 3 days. We found the source on the fourth day. We had the park closed. We felt we'd made a contribution to the public's health. I was very surprised when about 2 months later, into my office came the director of CDC with his shirt sleeves rolled up, holding this piece of paper. And he said, I want you to look at this. You have to imagine you're the lowliest person on the ladder and in comes the highest person and gives me this paper. He says, I want you to look at this and tell me if it's true. And if it's true, why did you do this? And I read the paper and it was addressed to the director of CDC. And it said to the director of CDC that when Dr. Rosenberg arrived at the park, he was shown some water samples, and we were told that what he said when he was shown those samples is, you've been drinking pure shit. Dr. Sensor, if this is true, why wasn't the park closed immediately? So this is what the director asked me to explain to him. But there was a congressional investigation, and the first 4 pages of the report of this investigation were, is this what Dr. Rosenberg said? And if so, why did he say it? And many people there tried to protect me. They said, no, you've been drinking human waste. There's a long discussion. I'm sure it's not one of the most sophisticated discussions in the congressional record, but it was quite an experience as an epidemiologist.
What was the outcome of that investigation?
The outcome of the investigation surprised everybody. We thought there were lots of people to blame. The superintendent, who had lost 35 pounds and saw all his staff getting sick, hadn't realized that this was anything out of the ordinary. and he let it go on for months and months before he called for help. The state had denied that there was any problem. The person who owned the lodge told his staff, who were sick and vomiting, sick with vomiting and diarrhea, he said, keep working, even though they were serving food and cooking food. We thought, oh my God, heads are going to roll. What we didn't realize is that it was our head at CDC that was going to be blamed, because all those other people were in the state. And the state senator who called the investigation didn't want to blame his constituents. He was looking to blame the feds. So CDC took the fall for this epidemic. And what we thought was proud work that we should be proud to stand by turned out to be something that got us in trouble with the Senate investigation.
Well, that leads us to another time in which you found yourself in hot water because of your work at CDC. In the mid-90s, you were named Director of Injury Prevention and Control at the Centers for Disease Control, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was a new division, and it was a relatively underfunded.
It was a new center.
Right.
It had its own three divisions, and it was for the first time ever we had a national center to focus on a national priority.
And what was the center's mission?
The mission was to address a problem that was the leading cause of death for Americans age 1 to 44, and that was injuries. And again, it wasn't the focal point of what people think about when they think about global health or public health. They think about infectious diseases. But in fact, Bill Foege recognized that injuries killed more people.
Foege was head of CDC at that point.
He was head of CDC. And he said, we've got to focus on injuries and violence prevention because that's killing Americans. It's not just infectious diseases.
I read an article that was written years ago about you when you were in that position, and it described the fact that you had in your office a big red A posted somewhere. What did that A stand for?
One of the reasons that injury never got much attention is that it's composed of two types of injury, unintentional injury and intentional injuries or violence. So unintentional injury for years had been called accidents. And these are things like falls, fires, drownings, car crashes. All of these are called accidents. An accident means that it wasn't predictable. It just happened. And if it wasn't predictable, it's not preventable. So people said, why even try? If these are just accidents, there's nothing you can do about them. What we felt was that these are not only predictable, but they're preventable.
So the big letter, red letter A, stood for accident, which you didn't believe belonged in the vernacular, in the vocabulary of this work.
We thought we had to get rid of that term. And we had a fine method for getting rid of it. And that is every time someone mentioned the A word, we fined them. We fined them 25 cents. It was too affordable, too cheap. It didn't totally work. But had we charged them something like, you know, $2,000 a pop, maybe we could have done something.
Well, these were government workers. I'm not sure you could have collected.
Government workers and Congress and everybody in the country. So we never really got rid of the word, but I think we started to bring attention to the fact that these injuries are preventable and understandable.
That was moving along, your work in that field, although you did, as you point out, have critics who felt that this was not really the proper work of the Centers for Disease Control. Mm-hmm. But then you took on a project which got you into the hottest water, I think it might be fair to say, you were ever in your entire career. You took on research on gun violence.
This was the other part of the injury problem. You know, the two leading causes of death from injury were car crashes and guns. And this country had done extraordinary work on car crashes. In the 60s, young women, people were dying en masse on the highways. And the government said, we're going to stop this epidemic. It's getting out of hand. And they took $200 million and they said, we're going to do research on motor vehicle crashes and how to prevent them. And they started the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration at the same time. And they gave them a budget of $200 million for research. And what they did was extraordinary. They really redesigned the car. Instead of a car with steering columns that would impale you and engine blocks that would crush you like an anvil, they designed steering columns that would collapse and steering wheels that would cushion you, front ends that collapse like an accordion to absorb the impact. And they designed side impact protection, rollover protection, seat belts, head airbags, main airbags. They totally redesigned the car. They redesigned the roads and they made them safer. And they redesigned the drivers. And as a result, we have saved over 300,000 lives from motor vehicle crashes. And what we said is the government has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on researching motor vehicles and making them safer. Why don't we apply the same scientific methods to gun violence? And we could probably save lives because the two were taking an equivalent toll. In many states, there are more deaths from guns than car crashes. In our state, Georgia, now we have that distinction. There are more deaths from guns in our state now than from car crashes. But we said, let's take science. Let's apply it to this problem. We said, let's take the same scientific techniques. Let's answer the four basic questions of science. What's the problem? What are the causes? What works to prevent it? And how do you implement it? And we thought we could save lives. We could save lots of lives. But that research drew the anger and ire of the NRA.
You did, before we get to that part of the story, you did learn some significant information about gun violence, I think. You learned how much more likely it was for a person to commit suicide if they live in a home with a gun, correct?
5 times more likely.
And then also how much more likely they are to be a victim of an incident involving that gun. Explain that a little.
Yeah, some of the first research that we funded on gun violence looked at the question, does having a gun in your home protect you or does it put you at greater risk? Because the NRA leadership had said that if you're a real man, if you care about your family, if you want to protect them, you'll have a gun in your home. And we looked at the question of, does having a gun in your home really protect you or protect your family? And what the research showed, and it's been repeated many times since, is that if you have a gun in your home, just as you said, it increases the risk that someone in your home will be a gun homicide victim by threefold. And it increases the risk that someone in your family will commit suicide with a gun by 5 times. The NRA did not like those findings because they wanted to sell more guns, and this was not going to help sell more
guns. Congress shut you down.
Congress did some things that really stopped us in our tracks. So there was a congressional hearing led by a man from Arkansas, a congressman from Arkansas.
Jay Dickey?
Jay Dickey, the very same person. And he was a born-again Christian conservative Republican from Arkansas who was the point person for the NRA. And he led what was really an inquisition when David Satcher and I went up for this appropriations hearing. But he grilled us mercilessly on this issue. And after that hearing, Congress decided to take away all of the money that our center was using to research gun violence. $2.6 million was taken out of the gun violence research budget and put into traumatic brain injury research. And they also inserted language into the CDC appropriations that said none of the funds appropriated to the injury center shall be used to promote or advocate gun control.
To be fair, there were people in the medical community, I think, who at that time also believed that CDC really didn't have a role, that, in fact, you were coming at that research from an anti-gun point of view to begin with, that you were looking to confirm an anti-gun agenda, right?
Well, the NRA leadership took what turned out for them to be a very smart strategic position. They adopted their zero tolerance policy. And they told people that if you allow research on gun violence to go ahead, then you will lose all of your guns. They said this is all or nothing. It's a slippery slope.
So NRA won, but two interesting things happened as a result of that controversy. Number one, you lost your job, right?
Right. I was fired from CDC. I was told you have to leave. I was not given a reason. I was just told you've got to go. You've done some good things. You've done some very good things, but it's time for you to go.
What was that experience like for you? How devastating was that at the time for you?
It was a horrible experience. It was humiliating because it's very hard as a federal bureaucrat to be fired. And it was embarrassing for people, the people you've seen as your colleagues, who you would hope would respect you, saw that I was fired. It wasn't a secret. And I wasn't told why I was fired. And you always think, oh, it's something that you did wrong. You really messed up. And it just made me think of all the nights, all the weeks that I had spent away from my kids and away from my family, trying to get this injury center started, trying to get the gun violence research going. It felt horrible. It felt like I was being sent into exile with shame and humiliation.
One of the things we should point out that's somewhat interesting about that is this happened during the Clinton administration.
It did. It happened during a Democratic administration, but I think the writing was on the wall. It was a Democratic administration, but a Republican Congress.
Right.
And they were the dominant force. And I think it was made clear to the director of CDC that many people in Congress, and this was not a secret, six senators signed a letter to the secretary of HHS asking for me to be fired and the injury center to be destroyed.
And that leads us to the heartwarming side of this story. In the years since, you and Jay Dickey have formed an alliance, a partnership. You both are now advocating for measures to control the proliferation of guns in this country.
What we're saying is that the current situation is intolerable. When Columbine happened, people paid so much attention to a mass shooting, and now mass shootings happen not once a year, once a month, every single day. And I think after the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, Jay and I, we read a comment from the president who said, this shooting is crazy and senseless. And what I think both of us felt, it's not the shooting that's senseless. It's predictable. It's happening on a regular basis. And if you let people who are paranoid schizophrenics and angry have guns, people will die. We said, what's crazy is not to do anything about it. And I think both of us felt at that time that the way out was doing the research, finding things that would work not only to decrease gun violence, but at the same time to protect the rights of law-abiding gun owners. And we thought we could have research that had two separate goals, to decrease the violence and to protect the gun rights of lawful gun owners. We can find things that will do both. And it's like in chemotherapy, when we try to protect patients, we have to get a chemotherapy that will stop the tumor, but will keep the patient's vital organs alive. But we can do it. People would not stand by for one day if we stopped research on cancer. There'd be such a hue and cry. Or if we stopped research on heart disease, people wouldn't let it go. And this is not only one day, but 20 years ago, we stopped the research on gun violence. We're paying a price that's totally unacceptable. And that's where I think Jay and I come together strongly. It can't go on.
If you had to sum up a lifetime in global public health in a minute, what do you say about what you've accomplished and how you've been fulfilled?
It's been an amazing ride. It wasn't the straight shot that I thought my life would take. I had amazing opportunities. I never guessed I would have done this. And I'm very grateful. It's been an amazingly lucky opportunity for me. Thanks for having me, Bill. I really appreciate it.
I've been talking with Dr. Mark Rosenberg. He's retiring from his position as president and CEO of the Task Force for Global Health at the end of this month. During his tenure there, he made the task force a vital institution for fighting disease around the globe. If you'd like to learn more about the work of the task force, go to the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS. We're almost out of time for today's show, but before we leave you, I wanted to remind you if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can always listen to us by downloading the Two-Way Street podcast on iTunes. You can also hear us on the GPB Atlanta app, where you'll find Two-Way Street, Political Rewind, On Second Thought with Celeste Headlee, and many of your favorite NPR shows. Our producer is Jenny Amond. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening today. Hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.